as much as we can. But what we've seen over the last 50 plus years in the region is that this project has led to the degradation of our ecosystems, from contamination to water systems, contaminations to food sources like fish and land mammals. We've seen the contamination to our air quality. And what this has led to is the degradation of the overall health of Indigenous communities and communities in the region, but also the overall health and survival of the culture and Indigenous rights of those communities that rely on those ecosystems for their rights. We all have jobs. This is great. We all have jobs, but at what cost? The cost is a degradation to our human health and safety, not just for this generation, but for multiple generations to come. We have not created the policies and the regulatory oversight to ensure the safety of our communities, to the point that we're still approving projects that aren't even meeting the bare minimum standards, that aren't even protecting environmental and human health rights now. We're approving tailings ponds and tar sands all the time.
Ariel Duranger, we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to do a part two, put it online at democracynow.org. Ariel Duranger is Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action. I'll be speaking in Atlanta, Georgia on Saturday at 5 o'clock. Check our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening. The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and up next is the KBOO Evening News.
In this, our 50th year, KBOO is honoring volunteers, staff, and board members from our early days with a program of stories and memories from the late 60s, the 70s, and the early 80s. Hear the voices of people who helped make KBOO what it is today on Thursday, May 31st from 8 to 10 p.m. Tune in and listen to the legends of KBOO's early history, or come down to KBOO for a reception and open house starting at 7 p.m. that evening. That's Thursday, May 31st, 8 to 10 p.m. when we present KBOO Recollections, The Early Days on KBOO Portland. We're celebrating KBOO's 50th anniversary on June 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society's Outdoor Plaza. Join us for music, fun, special guests, and bring a homemade birthday cake to share and help us celebrate. Bike to the party as part of our Pedal Palooza bike ride. The ride begins at 1 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8. Come ride your bike from our building to former locations of the radio station and end at the celebratory 50th anniversary of the very day we first switched on our transmitter and began broadcasting to and with the communities of Portland. Again, that's our 50th birthday party on Sunday, June 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the party and our history can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we take a look at the Portland Police Department's handling of Antifa protesters.
We hear from the Save Our Salmon campaign.
And we take a look at the most recent public safety forum.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 31st, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. According to the Willamette Week, the Portland Police Bureau is under fire for breaking a promise to delete photos of protesters' ID cards taken on June 4th of last year. At the time, a conservative protest group called Patriot Prayer organized what they deemed a freedom march in Chapman Square. The march occurred only days after the fatal stabbing on the MAX train in northeast Portland. In response to the protest, anti-fascist counter-protesters came out in droves to oppose Patriot Prayer. Portland's Independent Police Review conducted a review of police action during the protest. The review was previously embargoed. This morning, the embargo was lifted and the review became public. During the June protest, officers had detained 389 people through a technique called kettling. Kettling is a tactic for controlling crowds by creating cordons of police officers that force crowds into limited areas. The PPB is receiving criticism for treating Patriot Prayer protesters with more consideration than counter-protesters. The IPR's review also demonstrates that then-Police Chief Mike Marshman first denied that there were any photos taken of protesters. He then walked that statement back, claiming that the PPB would delete the photos of 389 people at the event who were not charged with any crimes. The PPB never deleted the photos. All of the photos are now under a court protective order and must not be destroyed. ACLU Oregon is suing PPB for the actions of officers on June 4th. PPB claims to be in the process of drafting policies to address complaints and concerns.
The issue of police conduct is not confined only to Portland. News organizations of many sizes, including the Oregonian, have attempted to access records pertaining to police conduct, only to be met with resistance. In January 2015, the Oregonian asked the Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training for access to electronic records on certification, employment, and training for police in Oregon. It took over 2 years for the Oregonian to be granted access to those public records. The Oregonian requested access to statewide data from the DPSST concerning cases in which state regulators considered revoking an officer's certification. The DPSST oversees the certification of officers and conducts reviews and evaluations of officers statewide. Regulators processing the request to access certification information put a $17,000 price tag on the data. The Oregonian went to the Oregon Attorney General protesting that high cost obstructed public access to important information. Even for the state's largest news organization, paying for access became unrealistic. The Oregonian also attempted to gain access from regulators to information on allegations against 210 officers. Regulators estimated that the request would cost over $29,000, but reduced the price to just over $14,600. Due to cost, the review of 210 officers had to be scaled down to 40 officers. The request for the release of records in relation to the 10 of the 40 officers were declined by local law agencies, but the Oregonian was once again granted access by the Attorney General because the information not released was deemed necessary to the public interest. Recently, the Oregonian's efforts have brought some changes to the DPSST. Closed-door meetings of work groups and subcommittees are now open to the public. Also, administrative closures, the names of officers with cases that have been closed and the reason for their closures, are now read openly in public meetings. But according to the Oregonian, the DPSST has worked to limit disclosure of records to the public. Last June, DPSST's director of professional standards, Lindsay Hale, emailed then Portland Police Chief Mike Marshman, making him aware of the Attorney General's orders to release disciplinary documents. Hale informed Marshman that he could suppress reporters' access to PPV records by asking the state to send an individual to read documents in person rather than giving the records to the state. Hale claims her advice to Marshman was solely concerned with records management, not to prevent transparency. With this morning's release of the IPR's report, it remains clear that misconduct remains prominent in both the PPB and the DPSST.
Hundreds of Portlanders gathered this past weekend to mark the one-year anniversary of the Max Train killings. The event also served as the unveiling of the mural at the Hollywood Transit Center to remember the courage of those who died that day. Three men intervened to stop a man who was harassing two teenage Muslim girls. The man responded by pulling out a knife and stabbing all three, killing two and severely wounding the third. Here's the voice of Sarah Farahat, the artist who led the team that created the commemorative mural.
My name again is Sarah Farahat. I would like to begin by acknowledging that we are standing on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Kitlamath, Clackamas, Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, and Malala peoples, and also many other tribes and bands that made their home here in Portland. Much suffering happened for all of us to be standing here today, and it didn't just start last year, but much longer ago. It is an honor to stand here as a guest on this ground. In the winter, I was tasked with creating this tribute mural, and it has gone through and continues to go through many transmutations in its becoming. Since April 20th, we have been painting, listening, sharing, and holding space for the community to remember and grieve, to recover joy, and to experience belonging. I don't think I truly understood what I was getting us into, but I don't regret any of it. It has changed our lives. I want to thank the Tribute Advisory Committee, first of all, for taking a chance on a woman of color. It is important that we continue to lift up perspectives and people that are underrepresented and then give them the opportunity to contribute and advance. Thank you to my painting team, some of whom are here today. You can raise your hand if you want to. Wendy Anderson, Daniel Hernandez Sandoval, Nikki Cayara, Amaya Okamoto, Jamali Roberts, Sultan Tamimi, and Asa Wright, as well as others, including Bilal Bahar, Elena Cronin, Liam Drain, North Pacific Signs, and Paul Watts for helping to design and protect this mural. To Alixa and Naima of Climbing Poetry for lending their words, the translators for making this poem come alive across languages, to local businesses for donations of materials and space, especially the amazing team at Orchard Hardware for letting messy painters use all of their facilities, to Michelle and the TriMet team, and to the impacted families for their support, to all of the transit riders who stopped to tell us their stories and give words of encouragement, to Rabbi Deborah Kolodny for her unceasing efforts in interrupting hate, to Lindsay King and the students of Beaumont Middle School for their brave, honest work, and of course, a special thank you to my family for their love and support. Our work is dedicated to the legacy of Ricky John Best and Talishan Murden Namkai Meche, to the bravery of Micah David Cole Fletcher, to the dignity of Destiny Mangum and Walia Muhammad, and to all people who struggle to thrive in their bodies in the face of great adversity. This work is for you. Thank you.
That was local artist Sarah Farahat speaking at the dedication of the mural at the Hollywood Transit Center 1 year after the MAX train killings.
The Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition is celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. Created in 1968, the Act preserves certain rivers' outstanding natural, cultural, and recreational values in a free-flowing condition for the enjoyment of current and future generations. Local company Sawyer Paddles and Oars is celebrating its 50th anniversary and sponsoring an event on June 8th with the Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition to bring more awareness to the issues affecting the Northwest waterways. KBOO's Zelos Zelos Marchand has more on this.
All right, I have in the studio local Andrew Strone representing Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition. He's representing Joseph Bogard, the executive director, who couldn't be here today, and Zach Kaufman of Sawyer Paddles and Oars, who's participating in this really great event coming up. Andy, thanks for coming down on a whim, honestly.
Thank you.
So, this is pretty special. There's a 50th anniversary for the Clean Water Act and for Sawyer Paddles. Do you want to tell our listeners about what the act means and why we should celebrate it?
It's the 50th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, which allows various stakeholders to come together and protect rivers or sections of rivers that they feel are important for the future of people and communities, and also for fish and the other benefits that we get from rivers. Sawyer Paddles and Oars is their 51st year, I believe, this year, but they decided to they decided to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act by sponsoring a fundraiser for Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition. Save Our Wild Salmon is a coalition of more than 50 organizations, from local fishermen's groups to large national organizations like the Sierra Club and everything in between, focused on the Pacific Northwest and, in this case, specifically the Columbia River Basin and the health and welfare of all of our rivers and wild fish and communities that benefit from them.
So it's a national coalition, or is it just a local coalition? It sounds like there's lots of different organizations and grassroots.
It's a regional coalition that has a few national partners, and partnering with the local or regional chapters or branches of those national organizations.
Wow.
But I'd say it's mostly grassroots local people involved in the coalition.
How'd you come to Save Our Wild Salmon?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Being around in the Pacific Northwest for 20 years and being a conservation biologist by degree.
Right on.
Participating in various organizations and activities.
Sounds cryptic, various environmental organizations. It just made sense.
I started going to events just like this one and got hooked, met people, and now 20 years later I'm supporting various organizations with these kind of events and activities.
That's great. What gets you to come back again and again to organize and help out coalitions like this?
Well, I've traveled around the country and the world a fair bit. And what I see is we're lucky here in the Pacific Northwest to have as much of the natural systems intact as we do. And it's important in so many different ways to our economy and also to our personal well-being, our culture, our social systems, I think, really depend on tangible and intangible benefits of those natural systems. So anything I can do to be working to protect those, support those, and to raise awareness of the importance of those, I like to be involved.
Excellent. What are some future plans for Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition going forward when it comes to clean water?
The big issue, I think, for Save Our Wild Salmon right now is the health of the Lower Snake River. There have been 3 court decisions in the last decade or two, federal court decisions, agreeing with the science that the current federal plan for those rivers and the management of survival of wild fish is inadequate, and ruling that the federal government needs to come up with a new plan, a different plan, to make sure that salmon in the Columbia River Basin and especially in the Snake River Basin don't go extinct. So the focus right now, one of the big focuses of Save Our Wild Salmon right now, is making sure that those court decisions are followed. It's one of the best opportunities, the best opportunity in recent history, to find solutions for both people and communities in that area that are depending on the current system, find solutions for them, and also change, as mandated by the court rulings, to also allow wild fish to continue to live in the Columbia River Basin.
Tying off of the salmon issues, are they really getting that close to extinction? And does the demographic or their population vary depending on which river the salmon are in?
You should come to the event and talk to the experts about that.
Okay.
What the courts have ruled is that the populations are obviously much smaller than they were in the past, and the courts have ruled that the study of what to do about this should include reasonable predictions of climate change, and that those things are not currently being adequately addressed in the existing plan. So the court decision and the science supports that without changing the plan, wild salmon populations may continue on a slow, gradual downward trend towards extirpation, local extinction, or possibly extinction in the basin.
Okay, well, let's circle.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
No. The courts have ruled that the current plan is not working.
Yeah, there's
a significant change needs to be made.
That's right. You could agree on that.
To make sure we have wild salmon in the river in the future.
That's right.
I can say that.
Great. And I don't, you know, does this court decision, and you may not have the answer to this or not, but how does that impact or interface with with Sovereign Nations, with First Nation tribes, and how they're trying to also preserve salmon, but from a really strong and valid heritage view. Is that, or does everybody win if this court, if the court case, you know, they get good evidence of climate change, which I would venture a guess, although I also can't speculate, you know, that would question. Be easy to prove.
That's a good question. And again, I'm maybe not the person to answer the technicalities of the legal decision.
Sure.
My understanding is that the court decision requires the government to study the dams in the Columbia, the federal dams in the Columbia Basin, study the management plan, include in their analysis things like a reasonable estimate of what climate change might be, what would the impact on river water temperatures and things like that, and then look at a variety of possible solutions for that, including current things like extra spill through the dams, just dumping water through the dams at certain times of the year to manage, to help the fish travel downstream, the young fish, maybe to mitigate water temperature a little bit. And there was also a requirement to study what would be the impact of significantly modifying some of the Lower Snake River dams or possibly breaching some of them as well. Not to say that that should be done necessarily, but the requirement is that those types of things be studied in addition to sort of the status quo model, so there can be a scientific comparison and to try to find what is the current impact, what will the current impact be in the future, and what are the range of possible solutions.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
All right. Let's circle back to the event itself coming up on June 8th, right?
Yes.
June 8th. Mm-hmm. So what can one expect at this celebratory event?
Well, we have a number of partners in addition to Sawyer Paddles and Oars and Save Our Wild Salmon. We have Orvis Fly Fishing Company. Pacific Rivers is a nonprofit organization here in Portland, Oregon. Patagonia. We have some local stores like Next Adventure involved in helping support the event. So we have a number of groups represented. We have Fly Fishermen Interest Group, the Whitewater Paddlers and Rafters, general sort of outdoor environmental people, all showing up to celebrate the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. The sponsors have also provided a number of items for raffle and silent auction, so there should be a lot of good, whichever of those buckets your interest falls into, there will be items there for you as well. We have some free food and snacks and salmon, drinks available. And we have a number of partners also have contributed short films. So we've got a big screen in the main part of the venue. We'll be showing about an hour of short films focused on the Pacific Northwest from each of those constituencies that I mentioned, and a chance to socialize with other like-minded people that have those kind of interests. There's more than 50 members in the Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition, so pretty much any way that you connect with water and rivers and outdoors and the forests that support and feed those rivers in the Pacific Northwest, there's going to be somebody from one of those constituencies, from one of those organizations at the event.
Cool. So, are there any other talking points you'd want to let our audience know about the very important court ruling and the coalition, maybe how they can get involved more if they want to join the coalition or support it in some way like you are doing? What can they do?
I think the best way to get involved and to find out the details, the accurate details, is to look up Save Our Wild Salmon on the internet. You can get involved with one of your local riverkeeper organizations, and really the best thing is to come to the event on Friday, June 8th. All those people will be there. You can pick which organization you connect with the best and get involved in the way that speaks to you.
All right. You know, I don't think we actually said we said Sawyer Paddles and Oars. Mm-hmm. Do you know the address offhand?
It's at Norse Hall.
Okay.
It's near the intersection of Burnside and Sandy in Northeast. It's 111 Northeast 11th Avenue. 111 Northeast 11th Avenue, and it starts at doors open at 6 p.m.
Okay.
On Friday, June 8th.
Okay. Great. Well, I've been speaking to Andrew Stone, a local environmental organizer representing Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition, and also sort of representing Zach Kaufman, who couldn't be here today, from Sawyer Paddles and Oars. And Andy, thank you again for coming down on the fly and talking to us about this really awesome event, and also just about the court rulings concerning our waterways and protecting salmon. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
This is Zelo Zelos Marchant for KBOO News.
The Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition event is holding a ticket giveaway. Call the Air Room at 503-231-8187 right now. The first two callers will have their names put on the guest list for the event. One more time, that number for the ticket giveaway is 503-231-8187. And the Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition event with Sawyer Paddle and Oar is June 8th at the Norse Hall, 11 Northeast 11th in Portland, Oregon.
Now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Northern Cheyenne tribe has partnered with a hospital in Montana to change how pregnant women or new mothers struggling with addiction are treated. As Yellowstone Public Radio's Jackie Almanaca reports, instead of punishment, women are being met with support services.
Social worker Maria Russell works with these mothers. She said when a woman is pregnant, she's highly motivated to be the best mom for her children. But sometimes, addiction gets in the way.
Addiction is about pain, and we're talking about a lot of pain, a lot of trauma.
So instead of blaming and arresting the woman and removing the child or children from the home, Russell said she's met with compassion and offers of help. That help comes from the Northern Cheyenne Tribe's new program known as Blessing New Spirits.
The thought behind it, you know, is a Cheyenne tradition of this is a new spirit coming, you know, and how are we going to greet that?
The tribe is working with St. Vincent Healthcare in Billings. Together, they're working to create a cultural shift between the medical community and addicted moms.
If we can support mothers with their children, that's our first love relationship. No one will ever replace our mom, no matter what. And if we can support them and build them up, then we have lifelong healing in the family.
Russell was one of the team members who briefed Montana Governor Steve Bullock on the new perinatal substance use treatment project. Bullock hoped others could learn lessons from this program. He cited statistics that of the 3,000 children in Montana's foster care system, over 60% were removed from their families because of parental substance abuse. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka.
Cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women in North America are underreported, and there's not a comprehensive data collection system in the U.S. One researcher is trying to change that, as Laura Morales reports from KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Arizona.
It's not mandatory for law enforcement to add missing people to a federal database, and some officers haven't gone to the effort of even listing a person's race on the police report. So Anita Lucchese has made it her mission to create her own database of murdered and missing Native women.
I was almost one of the women on this list. If something like that happened to me, I would want to be honored and remembered.
Lucchese, who is a Southern Cheyenne descendant, has gathered her data from public information requests, newspapers, social media, and other sources. And she's been able to detect some trends in her research, like the number of girls listed in foster care when they were assaulted or went missing.
We know that there's a relationship between foster care and trafficking, but the database is able to prove that. 65% of the girls who are in foster care when they went missing or were murdered were actually victims of trafficking or sexual assault.
On the Navajo Nation, there are more than 100 missing or murdered women in Lucchese's database. Council Delegate Amber Kanazba Karate has worked to pass stronger laws against trafficking and violence against women. She's also having tough conversations at home with her daughters.
I know in the research that I'm doing, it's 12 to 16-year-old Native girls. We know that they're being preyed upon. And not only is it my daughters, but it's their friends, our relatives, and our community. So we have to have these conversations.
Crady says talking about it, even though it's taboo, gives young women another layer of armor. For National Native News, I'm Laura Morales in Flagstaff.
A federal opioid task force recently seized thousands of pills, pounds of other drugs, and cash in a bust in and around tribal communities in Arizona. According to the Interior Department, this was the second such operation led by the group under the Trump administration's plan to address opioid abuse. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Black History 365 is a daily piece produced to showcase Black history for every day of the year.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is May 31st. On this day in 1921, a lynching was called for Dick Rowland for the accusation that he raped a white woman. This was the start of the most destructive race riot the United States has ever experienced. It erupted in the Greenwood District of Tulsa, Oklahoma, also known as the Black Wall Street. It is believed by historians that close to 300 people died during the riot.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. Bam! 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
No, I'm not flawless. I'm scarred up and I'm fine with it. My body are the laundry list of all of life's unkindnesses. But I still sip tea and chant om and live free because hardships and heartbreaks turn.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report from KBOO reporter Sam Bowman and his report from the latest Public Safety Forum. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather here in Portland and east of the Cascades and Hood River will be cloudy with a low of around 42 degrees, followed by partly cloudy skies and a high in the mid-70s. Today in history, the Battle of Jutland occurred on May 31, 1916. The battle was the largest naval battle in World War I. The fighting involved the British Grand Fleet and the German High Seas Fleet. 8,645 soldiers died in total, and the battle was inconclusive. The Battle of Jutland is considered a strategic British victory. After the battle, the German fleet never took to the sea again during World War I. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr. "I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word."
I was 14 years old, forcing pills down my throat, so my baby fat diminished. Still got these scars from cutting my wrist when I thought the life was finished. Now they remind me what my lows look like. Now I know the sky's the limit. Okay. Never claim to be.
The Public News Service is a member-supported media outlet that aims to cover issues that matter and may not be in the mainstream media. Here's today's roundup.
I'm Dr.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, May the 31st, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Media mogul Harvey Weinstein indicted on rape charges in New York. Also on the nationwide rundown, farm workers concerned about pesticide training, and some farmers turn thumbs down on the merger of Monsanto and Bayer. Plus, Puerto Rico fire stations get solar power on the eve of hurricane season. Now our top story, Harvey Weinstein indicted Wednesday on rape and criminal sex act charges. Yahoo reporting that is furthering the first criminal case to arise from a slate of sexual misconduct allegations against the former movie mogul. Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance Jr. said the indictment brings Weinstein another step closer to accountability. Yahoo quotes Weinstein's lawyer, Benjamin Braftman, as saying he would vigorously defend against the indictment. The lawyer claims that the allegations are unsupported and reiterated that Weinstein strongly denies them. Farm workers are suing the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for failing to make pesticide training mandatory across the agriculture industry. We get perspective from the Sunshine State and Tramell Gomes.
The Obama administration updated pesticide training rules in 2015. To date, the information that would provide the do's and don'ts of handling pesticides have been kept off the Federal Register, which would make them mandatory. Jeannie Economos is a pesticide safety coordinator with the Farm Workers Association of Florida. She says they've been working for 20 years to get protections for farm workers from exposure to pesticides, but their success has been blocked under the Trump administration, which she claims is ignoring common sense.
Thousands and thousands of public comments and their own research to try and roll back some of the protections for farm workers, including the minimum age, which we think is an absolute no-brainer. Nobody under 18 years of age should be handling toxic pesticides.
Opponents point to the information being publicly available for more than a year, but groups representing farm workers say the EPA needs to take more aggressive steps, considering the thousands of farm workers being poisoned each year.
The German pharmaceutical and chemical company Bayer is known for aspirin, but it's also a key manufacturer of seeds and pesticides. Now it's about to sweep up Monsanto, the U.S.-based agricultural giant. Linda Barr has reaction from Boston.
This impacts New England farmers who depend on vegetable seeds. According to Roger Johnson, president of the National Farmers Union, the $6.25 billion deal will consolidate control of more than a quarter of the world's seed and pesticides market.
This extreme consolidation drives up costs for farmers, and it limits their choice of products in the marketplace. It also reduces the incentive for the remaining agricultural input giants to compete and to innovate through research and development.
Bayer CEO Werner Baumann says his company wants to help farmers grow more nutritious food in a more sustainable way. The Farmers Union, which advocates on behalf of 200,000 farmers and farm communities nationwide, has pledged to ensure that Bayer keeps its word.
As the opioid crisis has grown in recent years, Ross Brown tells us so has the number of children no longer able to safely live with their parents.
Advocates say it's important to support the foster parents and extended families increasingly being called on to care for children. The group Generations United says as more U.S. parents addicted to opioids face incarceration, rehab, or overdose, more children are in need of safe homes, creating more demand for foster care. In a statement about the importance of foster care on the Senate floor this month, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley said 4,000 Iowa kids were in foster care during 2016. Nationwide, that number is 438,000. Generations United spokeswoman Jaya Lent says those numbers are only a small part of the picture.
For every one child in foster care with relatives, there are actually 20 being raised outside of foster care with grandparents or other relatives. So we really want to be supporting the children and the family if the child can't remain with their parents, whether they're in foster care or outside of foster care.
In response to the growing need for foster caregivers, Congress in February passed the Family First Prevention Services Act.
Several counties in Iowa are facing a shortage of foster homes, causing kids to be housed in shelters instead of with families. And finally, hurricane season starts tomorrow. Dan Hyman reports a nonprofit that's installing solar energy systems in some fire stations in Puerto Rico ahead of the season hopes it can show distributed power is more reliable for the island.
Myra Haynes with Empowered by Light says in May and June, it hopes to have solar with battery storage operating in 8 fire stations, with 10 more by the end of the year. She says car and battery maker Tesla is working on solar for a hospital, and nonprofits want to put solar in soup kitchens, schools, and community centers.
Those solar systems are designed to withstand winds up to 180, if not more, 180 miles per hour. And the idea is that then hopefully people can come in on a much, much larger scale doing it commercially.
An estimated 90% of the 3 million U.S. citizens in Puerto Rico lost power after Hurricane Maria. According to a recent study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, 4,600 people died, the largest portion because of interrupted medical care.
Defenders of traditional power argue it's cheaper, although the cost of renewables has fallen enough to compete directly. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Earlier this week in Arkansas, a law passed banning medical abortion, also known as the abortion pill. The Supreme Court has refused to step in, and for the time being, the law will stand. The law went into effect immediately, causing many who had already undergone the mandatory 24-hour waiting period to be turned away. Previous to the passage of the law, there were only 3 providers of safe abortions in the whole state of Arkansas, 2 of which were located in the town of Fayetteville and only provided medical abortion. The only other clinic and now only clinic in the state that provides safe abortion is located in the state capital of Little Rock. This is shown to disproportionately affect the poorer populations in Arkansas that will now have to make 2 trips to Little Rock in order to satisfy the mandatory waiting period, or will have to go to another state.
President Trump is adding another name to his list of full pardons. Conservative writer Dinesh D'Souza, who was convicted of campaign fraud. D'Souza admitted to willfully breaking the law and was prosecuted accordingly. He had never met Trump and was shocked by the pardon. He is best known as a conservative writer. This follows Trump's recent pardon of Scooter Libby, former aide to Vice President Cheney. Libby was prosecuted for obstructing justice, perjury, and making false statements in relation to the Valerie Plume scandal, which saw a CIA agent's cover leaked to the press by a member of the U.S. government. Plume at the time was married to a prominent anti-Iraqi war writer. Trump also pardoned Joe Arpaio in August of last year. The infamous sheriff from Maricopa County, Arizona, was convicted of a contempt of court when the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department failed to stop racial profiling after being ordered by the courts to do so. Trump also suggested that the public should be expecting even more pardons by naming 2 former contestants from his show, The Apprentice, Martha Stewart and Rod Blagojevich, as possible candidates.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has issued a daily tax for users of WhatsApp, Facebook, Twitter, and other social media platforms. The fine of 200 shillings a day, the equivalent to about half a cent each day, will go into effect on July 1st. The president told Reuters in March that, quote, "We're looking for money to maintain the security of the country and extend electricity so that you people can enjoy more social media more often, more frequently," end quote. However, opponents of this new tax, such as Nicholas Opio, a lawyer from Kampala, said that it is a new tool for stifling free expression and citizen organizing that has been beyond the control of the state. It's intended to curtail the ever-increasing central role of social media in political organizing. The government is claiming that this tax will curb the effects of, quote, gossip. The definition of gossip remains vague. The Museveni government had previously banned such social media usage during their 2016 elections, claiming that it would be used to support the opposition's protests.
According to The Guardian, Denmark is banning the use of garments intended to cover the face, including the burqa and niqab, which are Islamic veils. Denmark is following in the footsteps of Austria, France, and Belgium, which all have similar laws. Human rights campaigns, including Amnesty International, are condemning the law as a restriction of Danish rights to freedom of religion and freedom of expression. Europe Director of Amnesty International, Gwari van Gulik, criticized the decision, saying, quote, "This ban will have a particularly negative impact on Muslim women who choose to wear the niqab or burqa. The law criminalizes women for their choice of clothing and in so doing flies in the face of those freedoms Denmark purports to uphold," end quote. Those who violate the new law are subject to a fine equal to $160. For a second offense, the fine may be as high as $1,600, and punishment could also include up to 6 months of jail time. Danish Justice Minister Søren Pape Poulsen claims that it will be up to each police officer's personal judgment to determine whether someone is violating the new law. Controversially, the law passed in a 75-30 vote, with 74 lawmakers absent for the vote. The Danish government maintains that the law is not aimed at any particular religion. The law officially goes into effect on August 1st of this year.
listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman and CJ Fritz. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, positively revolting guest host Linda Olsen Osterlund discusses the recent decision by the NFL to fine teams whose players kneel during the national anthem. At 9, it's Pacific Underground, a show for and by the Asian and Pacific Islander communities in the Northwest. At 10, Valley Views talks to dietitian and nutritionist John Wymore about how people can achieve a healthy, satisfying quality of life. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, a Radio Geekly discusses the resurgence of the monster movie genre. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Last night, the mayor's office hosted its latest public safety forum. These events are held to fill the gap in civilian involvement before the city's latest attempt at a citizen advisory board for police issues is up and running. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman was there and made this report.
Last night, about 25 people sat in a circle in Fellowship Hall at the Vancouver Avenue First Baptist Church in North Portland for another in a series of public safety forums put on by the mayor's office. The forum was very informal and less well attended than the previous one I attended on February 28th. That being said, attendees included Mayor Ted Wheeler, Deputy Police Chief Bob Day, Assistant Police Chief for Operations Ryan Lee, two representatives of the Bureau of Emergency Communications, that is, 911, and a representative from the Independent Police Review. The forum was moderated by Nicole Grant, the mayor's senior policy advisor, and Mandy Hood, who is overseeing the rollout of the PSEP, which stands for, stay with me here, the Portland Committee for Community Engaged Policing. Community members present included both longtime police reform activists from groups like the Albina Ministerial Alliance and Portland Cop Watch, as well as a handful of private citizens. Some people just wanted to speak their piece to the powers that be, while others had more targeted questions for the mayor and police brass present. Unfortunately, the police review and 911 folks didn't get much play this time around. The conversation was dominated, overall, by questions stemming from the fatal police shooting of John Elifritz in April at a men's shelter in southeast Portland. Here, for example, towards the beginning of the forum, police reform activist and trainer Philip Wolf asks Mayor Wheeler about the lack of accountability for the 7 Portland officers involved. Wolf is speaking through an interpreter.
First, I want to thank the mayor for being here this evening. I feel that it's very important for the mayor to come to every meeting that we have because this is how we develop a relationship. And Ted, I remember previously after John Elifritz, after the incident, Ted, you made an announcement on Twitter about how the situation was unfortunate, that you feel it wasn't fair to add any more comments due to the pending investigation. You didn't want to make any assumptions until that had been completed. And since the investigation has been completed, there has been no police accountability. So I want to give you the opportunity to respond to us tonight, if you wouldn't mind. I would like to know where you stand and how you feel in regards to that, and what is your approach for the future, and what does that mean now that the officer has been released of all accountability?
So the officers, I believe there were a number of officers and a Multnomah County deputy. They went to a grand jury, and I want to be very clear, the grand jury looks at whether or not they have legal culpability. I believe every incident should be seen as an opportunity to improve training and leadership. My view, you know, just having read what I've read and listened to the various conversations, there were several interactions with Mr. Elifritz over the course of the day. I want to be clear, I wasn't there, but my gut tells me they made a good decision when, in their first encounter, they decided to back off and de-escalate. And it's my understanding that that is actually a trained tactic. I'm sure one of these folks here from the police bureau could say whether that's true or not. But it appeared they, at least through their grand jury testimony, they said they tried to de-escalate, they walked away, they either did or intended to engage the behavioral health unit, which is great. They were called to a potential carjacking. It led them to the shelter. I did watch the video that was provided from inside the shelter. There's a judgment call to be made. What I see when I look at it is he is moving towards the police officers. He has a knife, and they shot him.
Wheeler then, as he put it, rolled the movie back to respond to an earlier comment from a Copwatch member about wanting more options than simply calling the police when dealing with somebody who is in a mental health crisis or houseless.
By the time the police are intervening in a crisis, whether it is a mental health crisis, whether it is an addiction crisis, we've already screwed up. There should have been a more robust safety net in place around mental health. There should be a more robust safety net in place around addiction. All the upstream things that we do not do in this community, this state, or this country. We do not have an adequate mental health safety net here in the city of Portland, and I don't think there are many communities in America that have adequate mental health safety nets. And we could spend all night talking about that need. We have to change the paradigm around policing here in this community to be more reflective of the kinds of needs that are increasingly important right now. Mental health and addiction seem to be dominating what's going on in this community. I just had a very painful conversation before I got here with the family of an individual who was attacked by somebody on the street, and they wanted to know, what was I going to do about it? And the more we had the conversation, the more I realized, if people are waiting for Ted Wheeler to fix the problem of mental health delivery in America or the addiction problem in America, people are going to be dang disappointed at the end of the day. This requires the county's mental health infrastructure to shift. The resources that should have gone to the community when we decentralized mental health delivery in the state of Oregon never came to the community. It should. The federal government continues to pull back on everything from supportive housing, HUD housing, Medicaid support for organizations like Central City Concern or Cascadia or others that actually provide these services. And here we are in a circle wondering why the cops didn't fix everything. I will hold them accountable. I hope everybody at least knows that. I will hold them accountable, but we also have to hold ourselves accountable for putting into place the upstream infrastructure that will actually address the problems, as opposed to what police do, which is address the symptoms.
There were many, many worthwhile exchanges during the forum, both frustrating and illuminating and everything in between, and the full audio will be uploaded to the KABU website shortly. These included discussions of the prevalence of AR-15 rifles in police arsenals, the successes and failures of de-escalation training, how the new chief is doing in changing police culture, and the role of citizens in their everyday lives to not view people as threatening others. Philip Wolf, the activist we heard from earlier, here describes the de-escalation training he helped teach at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training in Salem, again speaking through an interpreter.
Because I have hosted the police training, it was a 40-hour training for the week, and I had interpreters. We discussed weapons, armory, we would do role-playing exercises. It was a 40-hour training. So I was able to witness that, and I think it's important to add in from my experience and my personal interaction with the police officers, both negative and positive from different communities, that overall, the conclusion that I have come to that I think is important to address is that during the police training, when I was the one lecturing, you know, they have certain roles where you're like a bad actor, you're paid to be in that role. I was uninformed of what the plan would be. It was just an impromptu situation we would have to address. So when I came into the situation, it was prompted that I was being shot at and the officer would then take out the assailant, thus protecting me. And as the person role-playing with that department for their standard safety training, I would be labeled as the bad person. I wasn't able to assault or go after the police in any way in that role. So being on both sides of that experience, now with my understanding after the police training and being back in the public, their response is different from what I've seen in the training. They don't have real ammunition. They don't have a real scenario. The people are labeled clearly as role players, and they're not able to mimic attacking the police. So when it comes to real life scenarios and real life situations, it's inapplicable. I believe there should be more thorough training to address that issue.
Another longtime community activist with the Albina Ministerial Alliance, Kaleigh Leuben, posed this question to the two police brass in attendance.
As long as the subject has come up, are the Portland Police Bureau still using hollow point bullets?
Assistant Chief Ryan Lee answered the question following a brief interjection from the Deputy Chief, Bob Day.
I'm not enough of a gun aficionado, hollow point bullets. I mean, I know that we use the 9mm round, but...
The answer is yes. The reason behind it, the logic behind it, is that the round, it reduces the likelihood that the round is going to over-penetrate. In other words, it's going to pass through a person and reduces the likelihood that it's still going to carry lethal energy downrange to somebody that's an unintended consequence. It also reduces the likelihood that it's going to pass through building materials. It's not probably the optimal solution for that, but that's part of the logic behind why those rounds are selected. That's pretty much so a standard in law enforcement in America for those reasons.
But that's why the people die.
That did not get an answer. The newest information gleaned from the forum is that the PSEP, a long-awaited replacement for the defunct Community Oversight Advisory Board, or COAB, or COAB, will not be rolling out formally for another month. Wheeler's senior policy advisor Nicole Grant explains. Nicole?
That's correct. Tomorrow we will kind of formally make an announcement, so we'll publicly announce that the application deadline has been extended to July 2nd. Our facilitators, the PSEP facilitators, so both Training for Transformation and the Brad Taylor Group, we really want them to be able to kind of engage in substantial outreach and reach community members who typically, historically, have not been at the table, right? I'm going to be really frank when I say this. Like, I know most of you in the room, right? And so I want to move past that. I think the city and the conversations around public safety need to be expanded kind of beyond those who have been typically engaged, right? Like, so we are grateful for your engagement and your kind of continued activism, but we don't hear from a sizable portion of the Portland community on law enforcement issues that impact members of the community who have not been at the table, and so we want an opportunity to be able to reach those individuals.
Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch pushed back on that, prompting a response from Grant.
What I'm hearing is the people who already understand how the police work and have concerns about them shouldn't be on this board. We should get people who don't know anything, because then it'll take us longer time to get everybody up to speed, and it'll take longer for this group to get together and do what it needs to do. That's what I hear when I hear we have people who aren't at the table. I think that those people who aren't at the table should come to those meetings and get informed and learn from the people who are on PCCEP. But if you exclude people who have been doing this work for years, then you're going to go back to what, you know, part of what happened with the CYB, no offense to those of you who were on it, is that there were people on there that had never understood what the police oversight system was or what was going on with police systems. And they had to, you know, had to hit the ground running at 0-60 in just a few days. And I think that wasn't really helpful.
I appreciate your feedback, Dan. And to be clear, we're not excluding anyone but city employees from this process. What I was getting at, looking around, you know, typically this is not a very diverse group of people. And when I attend like IPAC meetings, for example, the Interfaith Peace and Action, I'm gonna get this wrong, Thank You Collaborative, or the Community Peace Collaborative meetings, right? Those meetings look very different than these meetings. And I'd like to change that. I think that's really important. And so really all that I'm advocating for is that we reach different people. I think even if someone hasn't been actively engaged, civically engaged, I should say, over the last